You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Virgin Galactic Spaceship 2 spacecraft VSS Enterprise could be flying by this fall. It's designed to carry space tourists out of space before returning back to Earth. But if a suborbital joyride sounds tempting, you might consider the price, $200,000. And you also might want to read Mary Roach's latest book before you book your ticket. In it, she sidesteps the glorious aspects of space exploration and focuses on more mundane issues like bathing, eating, and how to mount a flag on the moon. Packing for Mars, The Curious Science of Life in the Void is published by W.W. Norton, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Mary Roach back to our show. So it's a pleasure to see you.
Oh, wonderful to be here.
Now, your previous books, Stiff, Spook, and Bonk, dealt with corpses, the afterlife, and sex, none of which prepared me for this as your latest topic.
Well, they are all, in a way, the peculiarities of the human body in under strange circumstances, you know, in a sex lab or on a slab in a medical research facility. So here again, we're looking at the human body enduring things it didn't think it would have to endure.
But there is a big break here. This is the first book with a multisyllabic title.
Indeed. Yes.
You begin by talking about the Committee on Symbolic Activities for the First Lunar Landing, which had to plan how to get the American flag on and into the moon.
Yes.
It took a lot of engineering?
It was months. Yes, the committee started meeting months ahead of time. The first problem, of course, being no atmosphere on the moon, no wind, so you don't have that wonderful, you know, patriotic flag rippling in the wind. So they sent the engineers off to develop a telescoping crossbar. So the flag, in fact, is less of a flag than a small patriotic curtain hanging there. That was just the beginning, though. They had to figure out, well, it's a flagpole is a cumbersome thing and you don't have a lot of space. So they figured out it has to be telescoping, very lightweight. They strapped it onto the ladder and then realized, oh, the engine blast is going to melt it, so they had to have a protective sheath for it then. And then they thought, well, what if the astronauts with their pressurized gloves don't have the dexterity to pull it out? Will they look like idiots in front of the whole world? So they did simulations where the astronauts came and pulled the flag out. And
well, you get the feeling that there isn't a single element that, no matter how mundane, that gets left to chance. But then you remember that space probe, the robot that was sent to Mars, where they did feet and inches and the metric system and combined the two and everything went haywire.
Oh, yeah. You think of the engineer who was responsible for that, and it just makes you want to cry because there's so much what-ifing that happens in all of these missions and redundant parts and contingency plans. And then you get tripped up by something as simple as that.
Like your previous books, this one is often hilarious. Are you suggesting that there's something foolish or ridiculous about space travel?
No, not at all. What I love is the combination of the sublime and the ridiculous. My favorite, I came across this point in a mission transcript, and it was wonderful. You can get these documents online and read through them, of these actual from the surface to the air communications. And there's this moment, Jim Lovell and Frank Borman in Gemini 7, I believe it is. And there's this moment where Lovell is saying, I've got this beautiful shot of the moon, a full moon, and the stratus formations of the cloud and the earth below. And it's this beautiful shot. And then Borman compresses the talk button. You have him speaking next in the transcript. He's like, Borman's dumping urine in approximately 1 minute. And to me, that's just space right there. Just the combination of this wonderful, spiritual, surreal environment, and then just these, you know, compromised hygiene situations, cramped conditions, discomfort.
And they have to report it all?
And what?
They report everything.
Oh, yes, and it's all in those wonderful transcripts, yeah.
I know an astronaut, but I'm grateful to you because you answer all of the questions I felt were too indiscreet to ask her.
That's my job. Leave it to me, yes.
And you sidestep all the flashy parts of the astronaut's job, the blast-offs and the spacewalks. But there may be a good reason. How much of an astronaut's career actually takes place in space?
The figure that I heard, about 1%. I talked to Chris Hadfield, I was at the Neutral Buoyancy Tank years ago, big swimming pool where they rehearse spacewalks, everything they're going to do in space. And he said, you know, I was talking about all this simulation. Does NASA go overboard with all the what-ifing and the simulating and the training? And he said, He said, "Well, yeah, I've been an astronaut for 6 years, and I've been in space for 8 days. This what I'm doing today. This is my job. What I do in space, that's not my job. My job is the training, the meetings, the planning. They help with preparing the spacecraft. They're at mission control. So yeah, very little of it takes place in space.
So 99% of it takes place in Houston, Texas.
Yep. Think twice before applying.
Even when they're on a mission, how much of their time is spent outside the shuttle?
Oh, well, an EVA, a spacewalk, would be a matter of hours. You know, his was a 6-hour spacewalk. So, and sometimes you're not doing a spacewalk. You may be just inside the space shuttle the entire time. So, yeah.
You say the biggest mechanical challenge is the human machine.
Yes, the human body, without gravity, some spectacularly odd things begin to happen to it. You pretty much name a body part, something odd is going on.
Well, for example, peristalsis. Doesn't that depend to some degree on gravity?
Peristalsis actually works quite well. They tested that back in the really early days of Mercury. They thought, what if people can't swallow? So they'd send on those parabolic flights where you have 20 seconds of weightlessness at a time. They sent up some Air Force guys with some food and said, see if you can swallow. And in fact, they were able to swallow. One of the things that does not work normally in zero gravity, the bladder. Okay, normally that works because there are stretch receptors. And as the bladder begins to fill, those receptors stretch because, the liquid is at the bottom and it stretches. And then that tells you, oh, time to go. Well, in space, because it's zero gravity, the liquid clings by surface tension all around the organ, so you don't get that same stretching. And then by the time you realize, oh, got to go, you could have the urethra could be pressed shut, and then it becomes a kind of a medical emergency. It's little things that you don't expect at all.
Since there's no privacy, what happens when they have to go?
Well, they have a little curtain that they pull.
Do?
But in the early, the Gemini and Apollo days, not only was there no bathroom, there was no privacy, your toilet was a bag, and you are right next. You're sitting on a love seat with your crewmate. You get to be pretty intimate pretty fast.
And toilets also depend on gravity. They obviously can't in zero gravity.
Yes, the gravity is what causes them. There's a term that they use at the Waste Control Department at NASA. It's called separation. The good separation is the holy grail there, because you want the material to fall away as it would with gravity. That's not going to work, so they use airflow. It's a very complicated machine. It's much more difficult to build a toilet for zero gravity than for gravity. So then they have to also test that, which means hauling it over to Ellington Field, putting it on the zero gravity flight, 22 seconds in which to test it. That's a challenge, as you could imagine. You know, mm-hmm. Ready, go.
And oops.
Yeah. Yeah.
Can I have another 10 seconds? Weren't scientists worried at first about astronauts' eyes changing shapes, or that their blood would coagulate?
Yes, there was this, to me, fascinating era in the 50s of kind of organizational hand-wringing, where because no one knew, when you take gravity out of the equation, what will happen to the human organism? And yes, they thought that the eyeball would change shape. And you wouldn't be able to see, possibly. And if you look at there's a mock-up of John Glenn's capsule, and you could see there's a little Snellen eye chart, and he was under instructions to glance every so often, glance at the eye chart and make sure his vision was not deteriorating. They thought that the blood might just churn in place, that it needed gravity in order to circulate. They thought that, and they were right about this, the bones in the inner ear, because those little bones, normally on Earth, they're resting at the bottom of the chamber of the inner ear. Well, when you're in zero gravity, they float. In zero gravity, they float, which is very confusing to your vestibular system.
Would your liver float as well?
All of your organs float. This is great. It's called the space.
My pancreas would be floating if
yes,
I were
yes,
in outer space.
Everything's floating. But for women, it can be a real boon, because it's called the space beauty treatment. Your organs float up under your rib cage a little bit. So your waist is narrower.
You don't need plastic surgery.
Your breasts are very buoyant. There's no sagging in zero gravity. Your hair is very full. Your wrinkles plump up because you have more fluid in the upper half of the body. Bear in mind, though, I've also heard this called puffy face chicken leg syndrome.
Mary Roach is my guest. Her latest book, Packing for Mars, The Curious Science of Life in the Void. It's published by Norton. Do different countries look for different things in their astronauts?
They do look for different. Well, they. It's more that they have a different way of finding the people that they want. I spent time in Japan. The Japanese Aerospace Exploration Agency has an isolation chamber, and there were the day that I went, the 3 days I was there, there were applicants, people applying for their finalists in the to become astronauts for Japan. And I kind of expected, you know, in this, there were psychiatrists watching and taking notes and trying to figure out who would be best adapted for life in space. And I was imagining that they would set up, you know, emergence, like setting a fire in the sleeping chamber and seeing how they dealt with the emergency. But in fact, they did things like there was a test where each applicant had to make 100 paper cranes, origami cranes, and string them on a string, which was then given to the psychiatrists, who looked at how do the first cranes compare to the last? Are the last ones sloppy? Did the person was under, because you know you're timed, and they were looking essentially, it was a test of accuracy under pressure and patience, because space can be very repetitive. There you can be tightening a series of bolts and going through the same motions over and over. And so I thought that was an interesting get at it.
You say that. Today's heroes in space exploration aren't the swaggering John Wayne types, more like, you say, Richard Gere in Knights and Rodanthe. He was an extremely sensitive person.
Yes. Well, in the early days, it was one man going up in a capsule for a couple of hours in a very risky, very unusual and new situation. You wanted someone who was macho and brave. Now you're looking at weeks or months trapped in a room with five other people, and you don't want that's the right stuff of the Mercury era is really, really the wrong stuff. You want some of the actual attributes I've seen on one list that were ability to relate well with others, with empathy and sensitivity, ability to form quality and stable interpersonal relationships, ability to handle boredom. I didn't see that coming. Fairness, flexibility, sense of humor. So you want a group player, somebody who plays well with others.
When someone asked my astronaut acquaintance about the smallness of the space shuttle, she pointed out that once you're floating in zero gravity, there's a lot more space available to everyone. So those six people have a bit more space, at least because they're floating above each other's heads.
You could be sitting on the ceiling where, you know, you and I, we've got, you know, there's all this unused space above us right now that could be used. Although it's considered inconsiderate in space to be hanging upside down while everybody else is right side up, because it's hard to read lips when somebody, and we depend on the visuals when people are speaking more than we realize.
Whenever this this sort of thing comes up, people always wonder about whether anyone has ever had sex in space. Do we know if it's ever happened or whether it would be possible?
Well, there are two missions that about which there are rumors. One was a mission with a couple of cosmonauts, Elena Kondakova and Valery Polyakov.
Leave it to the Russians to do it first.
Yeah, and I spoke to a cosmonaut. I asked him. I said, "Okay, everybody said they were flirting. What really went on?" And he said, "We were asking him all the time. Did you have sex?" He goes, "Don't ask me this question." As it turns out, the woman is married to another cosmonaut, so that would have been a particularly sticky.
And we don't want her driving all across Siberia to kill somebody.
Exactly, wearing a diaper. Yeah, and the other, there was a couple that got married before they went up on a shuttle mission. They didn't tell NASA, because NASA doesn't send married couples. Their reason being, were there a disaster, an accident, the children, you know, would be parentless. That's one reason. Also, the couple would have possibly to choose between the mission and the spouse, and so they don't. But this other couple, NASA doesn't comment. I doubt that they did. I mean, my personal feeling is that they're. Astronauts invest so much in their careers. It's such a difficult career, and why would you risk? You'd be risking losing your job. On the other hand, a friend of mine said, "Might be worth it." No.
Well, what's the protocol if your partner runs out of oxygen or passes out on a spacewalk? I would assume that if you're married, you might react in a different way than if you were just being professional.
Right. I remember reading about some minutes of a meeting after Apollo. There were astronaut feedback was being gathered, and one of the questions was if the spacewalker dies or loses consciousness, and what do you do? And the answer was cut him loose.
Mm.
And Yeah, if you had a couple, then how would you, you know, if it was your wife or your husband that was out there, then how do you follow, how do you follow protocol? Yeah.
There's a rumor that vomiting in your spacesuit is instant death. Is that true?
No, no, unless you've got a really, really shoddy spacesuit. And even then, you have a cough reflex. If you're not very, very drunk, a la Jimi Hendrix, and you inhale liquid, you will cough it back up without, it's just a reflex. The other thing going on is the spacesuit has these air channels that are coming down over the face, and it would wash the material into the suit, which is revolting but not life-threatening. The most dangerous thing about vomiting in your spacesuit, and the reason it's something NASA is careful about, is that the visor would be obscured with splatter, and that could be life-threatening. If you can't see out when you're out on the arm, you know, of the space station or something, you could be, get yourself in trouble pretty quickly.
Do people experience things like motion sickness?
Yeah, space motion sickness.
Can you get high up there because you're in a different kind of floating around?
Oh, I thought you meant using marijuana to treat nausea.
No,
I'm thinking NASA. Let's call NASA. Maybe they should consider that. Yes, space motion sickness is really common in the first few days of a mission. I was on the wait list, the vomit comet, as they call it, but they give you drugs, which are very effective. But astronauts don't take the drugs because they need to adapt. I mean, the drugs delay your adaptation. Your system has to readjust. And it was interesting, when you come back down, you get Earth sickness because you've adjusted to space. And so now you're down on Earth and you feel like you're Peggy Whitson described it as, instead of me going around the Earth at 17,000 miles per hour, it was the Earth going, well, the reverse.
Well, how long have people been up in space? What's the record so far?
There's a pair of some cosmonauts have been up, Valery Polyakov, and it's over a year, I believe. I'm not sure the exact number.
Of course, they've had shuttles come up and
resupply missions.
Resupply. But what do they do about eating fresh produce? Or, in fact, do they ever eat meat? Can they cook anything up there?
No, not at this point. There were some wonderful, in the 60s, some papers, theoretical papers on what would we do if we went to Mars. And one person actually worked out the caloric efficiency of different animals brought up and figured out that rather than bringing a steer, which was very inefficient because you needed all the food to feed the steer, that the astronauts should raise and eat mice. Mouse stew was the recommended meal. But there have been greenhouses in space and people. And the interesting thing is astronauts get very attached to the plants because it's the only natural thing on board. This wonderful quote in one of the cosmonaut diaries referring to these flax plants. He said, they are our love.
Now, we have put off any mission to go to Mars, but is Mars worth it?
I would love to see a mission to Mars. I mean, the obvious argument against it is the expense. It would be a tremendous expense. But if you made it an international, sort of a global effort where you had different nations contributing expertise and technology and money, we'd probably, that would be the way to do it. And you'd also it would just bring everyone together in this way that we haven't been since Apollo. The Apollo lunar landing was just, everyone was watching. And I would love to see it in my lifetime. I probably won't.
Would you want to go up there? You went through zero gravity training, didn't you?
I did go through zero gravity training. Mars, no, I'm not Richard Gere and Knights and Rodanthium. Do not send me up with five other people. No. Moon, I'd love to go to the moon. Two weeks on the moon, absolutely. Sign me up.
What about the Virgin Galactic? You'd only be up there for a very brief time.
Yeah, maybe one day. But for me, the moon would be. I'd shell out some bucks to go to the moon.
Well, this book may wind up becoming a bestseller, and you may have the $200,000 to pay for that.
Fingers crossed.
Mary Roach's latest book is called Packing for Mars, The Curious Science of Life in the Void. It is published by Norton. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you, Leonard.